Next appeal set for argument this morning is Mark Feichner versus American West Insurance Company, appeal number 30841. Mark Arndt is present, will be arguing on behalf of American West, and Seamus Culhane is present, will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Feichner. Each party will have 15 minutes, and then Mr. Arndt, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. Mark Arndt on behalf of American West Insurance Company. Since this court first started issuing opinions on the topic of first-party bad faith insurance, it has recognized the doctrine known as fairly debatable. The Champion case in 1987 by this court recognized that doctrine. Our initial brief cites a couple of other follow-up cases in which this court has recognized that doctrine, including Harvey O. versus Progressive, in which this court stated in 2018, in bad faith cases, the insurer and the insured are adversaries, and therefore an insurer is permitted to challenge claims that are fairly debatable. A little more detailed, a couple of years later in 2020, in the Johnson versus United Parcel decision, this court stated, if an insured's claim is fairly debatable, either in fact or law, an insurer cannot be said to have denied the claim in bad faith. The fact that an insurer's position is ultimately found to lack merit is not sufficient by itself to establish that the insurer had a reasonable basis to deny the claim. The focus is on the existence of a debatable issue, not which party was correct. There's no question the facts of this case, to some degree at least, are undisputed, at least as it relates to the jury's verdict in this case. The very first question this jury decided was the breach of contract claim. Also can be referred to as the personal injury claim or the UIM claim. For purposes of oral arguments this morning, I know the briefs may have referred to that first decision by the jury as any three of those labels. I'm going to refer to it as the UIM, underinsured motorist claim, but it's also could be known as the breach of contract or personal injury claim. It's all the same as it relates to this litigation. There's no dispute of fact that the jury's verdict on that issue determined that Mr. Feichner's UIM claim had a value of $400,000. His personal injury claim, as it relates to in the UIM context, had a value of $400,000. That's on top of the $100,000 he had received from the tortfeasor and the $10,000 that American West had already paid him for medical pay benefits under his own policy. There's no dispute of fact that Mr. Feichner, prior to the litigation, demanded that American West pay him $900,000 for his UIM claim. And there's no dispute of fact that American West, in response to that demand, said, we don't believe your claim is worth $900,000. We will offer you another $10,000 on top of the $100,000 that you already received from the tortfeasor and the $10,000 that we've already paid you under your med pay benefits to resolve this claim. So we're going to challenge that your claim is not worth $900,000 of UIM benefits, that your personal injury claim is not worth a total of over $1 million.
And your argument is that because he asked for $900,000 and we offered $10,000 and the jury gave $400,000, it's fairly debatable.
That's correct, Joe.
Any other grounds to argue that it's fairly debatable beyond that?
Well, I guess that's certainly the primary grounds. I guess we can talk about any of the other issues that were raised in the briefs on appeal.
Well, what other ground? Tell me what other ground you're asserting.
The primary claim is that the verdict itself is inconsistent.
What's the secondary claim?
The verdict is inconsistent, Your Honor. The $400,000 verdict on the UIM claim is inconsistent with the finding of bad faith and punitive damages.
So explain for me how that argument would not work in any case where a claimant is asking for an amount of money, X, in any case that he receives any amount less than X. Well, how would that argument not work?
Unless there was some other act of bad faith by the insurance company, it wouldn't. I mean, if the insurance company and the claimant have a genuine dispute about what the value of a very subjective personal injury claim is, and the jury determines that the amount is the midpoint, which was essentially this case, between the two parties' positions, that by definition is fairly debatable.
No, but that's, I don't think that's what the law is. The law is, was the insurance company's offer unreasonable? The first prong of it, you know, objectively looking at all the facts, what the insurance company had in front of it, and of course we've got this, I think the primary claim is you didn't adequately investigate it. But set that aside for a moment. You're talking about the merits of the claim. Let's assume whatever that claim is, was it objectively reasonable? It doesn't matter what the jury ultimately concluded. The question is, as the insurer, did you adequately investigate, consider this claim, and was your offer reasonable? And what made that claim unreasonable objectively? Isn't that really what your argument is? Is that it's got to be shown that our offer was objectively unreasonable?
Well, it is in the context of this court's precedent. Again, fairly debatable fits within that, right? So, if the court's question is, well, it's fair that the plaintiff can demand the policy limits of $900,000.
But the plaintiff's demand has no relevance. The question is, did the insurance company fairly value this claim? That's the question. It doesn't matter. I mean, you could come in and ask for $5 million. You know, and you know, that doesn't mean make your claim any more or less, or your offer any more or less reasonable. The question is, did you fairly value this claim?
I do agree with the court that the insurance company has to investigate and fairly value the claim. I respectfully disagree that the plaintiff's demand is not relevant to this outcome. I mean, why would one party be able to make a demand under a breach of contract claim that is completely unreasonable while the insurance company is held to a different standard?
Because the cause of action is relating to your duty of good faith relative to the insured, and we're not litigating whether the insured somehow breached a duty of good faith to the carrier.
Well, the first cause of action is breach of contract, to which both parties have a good duty of good faith, right? The second cause of action is
right, but I mean,
faith.
You're not. There's no claim that they breached the contract, so or that their demand in some way.
The contract doesn't require them to submit a reasonable claim.
I guess I disagree. If the duty of good faith applies to both parties in a contract, why wouldn't the plaintiff have to submit a reasonable demand?
Perhaps, but in any event, we're not litigating that breach of contract claim. There's no counterclaim, right?
Fair.
And we're litigating the breach of contract claim, or you all are, relative to the carrier's not only duty under the contract, but ultimately their tort duty to act in good faith. So the proof is in the pudding kind of argument really only gets at whether there was some proximity in the ultimate result relative to where the parties were when they left the negotiating table. How does that shed any light on either breach or good faith, bad faith?
Well, it sheds light because, again, there's only one body that can determine what the very subjective value of the personal injury claim is, and that's the jury. The jury determined it was $400,000. That's closer to the amount of money that American West offered before litigation than the plaintiff.
And that's the point I want to ask you about. So you're making, and I saw in your brief, a range of offers argument. In other words, so you offered 10, the jury awarded 400, so 390.
Yes.
The difference and versus the $900,000 request and the fact that they were $500,000 then off. So you're arguing my range of offers was our range of offer was more reasonable. Wouldn't that incentivize lowball offers, though, such that likely any jury verdict would lie within the appropriate range? I mean, wouldn't that, if we were to adopt that argument, wouldn't that incentivize a lowball offer?
No less than it incentivizes the current state of affairs, which is plaintiffs have no reason to make anything but an unreasonable demand. Because if we can't accept that a jury's verdict determining the actual value of those amounts does render a claim as fairly debatable, then why would a plaintiff ever have a reason to come to the negotiating table and act fairly?
But ultimately, though, the question really is, well, maybe, does it seem like the question is less adversarial, less about what they do and what you do in response and the moves and the counter moves and all of that. But isn't it, as the Chief Justice said, ultimately a unilateral obligation that the carrier has to say, look, we've investigated it, we think this is what it's worth, and it doesn't matter, as we said in Johnson versus UPS, which was taken from, I think, the Champion case or the DM&E case, but it doesn't matter ultimately whether it's right or not right or which party's right or not right. What matters is that the carrier, not in reaction to something that a plaintiff asserts, but in its own sort of obligation to discharge its duty of good faith to fairly evaluate the claim, says, I think we're right. I think this is fair. And so, and as Mr. Colhane mentioned in his closing argument, the rebuttal closing argument, you know, in his submissions sort of go to this, and I'm interested in your views on it. Hey, it's not about debatable. You can't skip over the fairly part. And maybe the fairly part incorporates this idea of, hey, how fair was this offer? What did you do to make sure you got a fair offer? And can the jury consider all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the court is on that topic. And I would refer this court to the authority in the Anderson versus Western National decision that Judge Lange issued back in 2012. I recognize this court isn't bound by the federal district court's precedent, but if you look at the facts of that case, which we cite on page 15 of our first brief, they are so close to the facts of this particular car accident, and it was dealing with whether or not a UIM claim of $100,000 was fairly debatable or not in that Western National claim. And Judge Lange decided, as a matter of summary judgment, taking the facts in light most favorable to the claimant, that the issue was, in fact, fairly debatable as to whether that injury with $20,000 of medical expenses and a plaintiff bashing his head through the back of a window was, in fact, as a matter of law, fairly debatable.
Can a carrier, when adjusting a first-party claim like this, can a carrier say in a – because I don't know that case is – I mean, it seems like a result more than a rule, because it seems like these cases are all highly fact-dependent in terms of what the carrier does, doesn't do. So, for instance, in a case where a plaintiff is saying, look, whatever my specials are, they are. Whatever my meds are, they are. I've got this issue. I've got that issue. I've got this issue. They're not resolved. Can a carrier, when they're adjusting that claim, just say, look, you know, whatever, $20,000 in meds, low-speed crash, we're here, we're not doing anything else? Or do they have an obligation to sort of kind of come out there and contemplate what the plaintiff is saying? You know, whoa, you say you've got these problems? Okay, yeah, I mean, notwithstanding the modest amount of $20,000 amount of meds, okay, before we say they're not related, do we have to have some basis for that? I know it's debatable, but is it part of being fairly debatable to run that down and sort of say, no, we're comfortable with where we're at?
Absolutely. I think every case is going to be different. They're all going to be snowflakes. I think the precedents from many jurisdictions across this country establishing the inherent subjective value of a personal injury claim is absolutely correct. And I think it was correct, and that analysis can be used in this case. And to the court's question, and I know we're going to get to this at some point, but if the court has some doubt about the fairness of the debatable issue, I urge the court to look at the trial exhibit number 3, which is at the record page 1755, the 8-page UIM evaluation prepared by American West when fairly considering Mr. Fichtner's claim. It is in great detail. I would suggest to the court that no one can look at this document with a straight face and say American West didn't properly consider this claim. There is all kinds of detail and analysis in this document from a lay claims adjuster who was doing her best to evaluate this claim. And you can disagree with her conclusions because, again, these claims are highly subjective. But I don't think anybody with a straight face can look at this document and say American West just plugged their ears and turned a blind eye to his claim. That's not true. That's not the facts of this case.
Thank you, Mr. Arnn. Mr. Colhane, you can proceed with your argument.
Sorry. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Subjective to whom? They never called Mark Fichtner. Apparently, these damages are all supposed to revolve around what impacted Mark Fichtner, but they never called him. It feels like this subjective argument can be moved from the adjuster, who's medically untrained and overworked, and frankly, it's not her fault that she's handed the number of claims she is. She also is just trying to make a living, pay for her kids at school and family and so forth. So when she's incentivized to reduce investigation expenses and she's incentivized to reduce indemnity expenses, you end up with this inexorable conclusion that, of course, these claims aren't going to get fairly handled. Subjective to the insurance company? I'm not really sure how that would work because it's an entity. And the defense points out that there's only one body that can determine the value of these claims. That is false. This is the business of insurance. This is what makes insurance work every single day. If every claim had to go to a jury to get adjusted, it would be extremely inefficient. It would, for the reasons we've briefed, dilute the benefits that were ultimately supposed to be paid, and it creates this unreasonable delay like we've now experienced in this case. As I stand here, American West still hasn't paid anything towards the UIM benefits. The jury determined, after hearing 100% of what's been argued, the facts, the law, the jury instructions, the things the adjuster had at the time they made the decision not to pay more, things that came up during the litigation, like the neuropsychological expert, things regarding Mr. Fichtner's heart and alcohol use, things that weren't relied on in the first instance when the decision was made, they got to argue all of that. And after hearing all of that, the jury determined that the claim should have been paid in October of 2019. That verdict and judgment's now more than a year old. It's not even contested. We're here with an uncontested verdict on the contract damages and the interest on those damages.
So let me ask you about, seems like the theme of your case, or what you were really arguing to the jury and what the assertion was, claim wasn't adequately investigated. Insurance company siloed things. They didn't look at into depth. They didn't call my client. They didn't get an IME. They didn't do a lot of things that maybe they should have done in this case. That seems like really the theme of your case. Is that fair?
Yes.
So then my question is, when we get to the law, and there's a lot of law out there that there is an obligation, and the investigation is part of the looking at the reasonableness of the insurance company's offer. But an inadequate investigation in and of itself according to most authorities, is I don't think we've decided that issue in South Dakota, but an inadequate investigation in and of itself is insufficient to establish bad faith if the claim is otherwise fairly debatable.
Okay, is there a question?
Yes. I mean, do you agree or disagree?
I think that the DME case makes it pretty clear that a lackadaisical investigation.
Right, but there's some other facts in that case. When you look at that case also indicates that the reason the investigation was significant is because the insurance company said, yeah, we aren't going to pay any uninsured claims because we don't think it was our driver. Okay. Driving. And so the investigation, there was some indication the investigation would have shown otherwise. And so there the inadequate investigation mattered. So the question here is, in my mind, let's say there's an inadequate investigation. You made a demand for $900. Response is $10,000, $110,000. And so you got $20,000 in economic. No claim for future medical, no claim lost wages. So you got about $100,000 in non-economic loss.
Sure.
What about the investigation, if an investigation had done, would have changed that assessment and made that assessment unreasonable? Or was it unreasonable in and of itself from your perspective?
Both unreasonable inherently and also as a result of failed lackadaisical investigation. From the beginning, I understand how insurance companies work with their computers and formulas and software that wants to plug in numbers and ICD-10 codes. When something like this comes up to an insurance adjuster who's supposed to be a high-level adjuster, and you see that kind of a discrepancy, if it were me, I would say, well, why don't you give the guy a call and find out what we're missing here? Like, what's going on? Because on paper, bills and records don't make it look like it's quite as terrible as he's certainly claiming. Now, maybe it's unreasonable to suggest $900,000 is too much, but for double vision, for other vision issues associated with not being able to see, I wouldn't trade that amount of money for what Mr. Fichtner was reporting to his doctors. Secondly, when you look at things like the relatively significant medical history that was attempted but not terribly useful, they didn't contact any of the treating doctors either. That was an ineffective investigation, and it's not because they just decided not to in this case. They never do. And apparently they're not going to change. And not only did they not do that, their own investigation didn't even contact the eventual neuropsychologist who they hired after litigation was instituted. So unlike the Anderson case, where you've got a lawyer and a CPA giving written numbers about what some of the disputed facts are, there was nothing here. Like, literally, there was no basis. To the extent the UIM evaluation came up as being the de facto objective reasonableness, we had to start the lawsuit. I was midway through the deposition of the adjuster, Abby Kramer, before she spilled the beans that thing even existed. I asked about it before. I specifically requested it in the emails when we were discussing the numbers. Not disclosed. The email just says we relied on facts of the loss, the police report, the impact, and I think maybe property damage. Never once until the lawsuit was instituted and we go through what ends up being pretty significant discovery in these cases, certainly 1,000 pages or more, it's not disclosed. And so you talk about failed investigation. To me, that's failed processing. Because at that point, how are we supposed to have a debate or a discussion about eye issues being related when we don't even know that thing is still an issue at the insurance company because they're hiding the documents that they now want to rely on? And that's really what we ran into all the way through trial, was the time and place for this was back in October of 2019. The case law seems pretty clear to me that you don't have to go through a jury to get UIM benefits. In fact, if you do, the legislature has said that is de facto unreasonable, and you get more than what was offered, significantly more, I believe. And so we end up at this position where they want to argue sort of Monday morning quarterback about all this valuation stuff when they didn't do any of the playing on Sunday. They just ignored it for the most part the whole time. And today, they have made the conscious decision to still, despite the judgment, despite the uncontested nature of the contract benefits, have not paid them. And so I don't think anyone would say, would look at a UIM policy, or which is mandatory coverage in South Dakota, and say, yeah, you got to go through trial, then you got to go through appeal, and even when they say that they owe it, when they admit they owe it, after a jury's told them they owe it, after a judge has told them they owe it, we're still not going to pay. And that really, the delay...
But we don't have like a continuing bad faith claim, though, like that we're litigating on appeal. I understand what you're saying, but I mean, those aren't really the issues that are presented for appeal. I understand that those events, as they played out during the pendency of the appeal, are to be frustrating, but that's not really germane to the issues that we have on appeal.
To me, it goes to the company's credibility, Judge. I mean, how can we take anything they say seriously when at this point they've conceded that by more than a year?
But they don't change the nature of your claims below.
The
validity of your claims below are not based on what they've done since the jury trial.
And interest is running.
I assume there's a bond or some sort of undertaking.
Sure. That delay, deny, defend has really been what's, I mean, occurred the entire case from the very beginning.
Let me ask you this, if I could, please. So let's talk about numbers. It's 10,000 new money versus 900 and all of that. And they land in the midpoint and, you know, and Mr. Arndt, you know, argues that there's significance to that and has arguments in that regard. Is it possible, even not necessarily with respect to this case, but is it possible that the parties could be that far apart? Let's say there's a $10,000 new money offer by a first-party carrier in a UIM case. It's $1 million off of where the plaintiff wants to be and where they demand. Is it possible that the carrier could still discharge and be discharging its obligation as you see it with that low offer under circumstances that are different in terms of the investigation? In other words, it could be a low offer. It just has to be based upon something that you envision being different in another theoretical situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, if the
like
value
what?
Isn't
like
there.
Like what, though? What would that look like? Just well, curious. I'm sorry.
They would have won.
No, but I mean, what kind of things would they do? And I'm not holding you down to, like, the definitive standard, but just, for instance, what sort of things would make that debate, as you mentioned in your closing argument at the trial, fairly debatable?
Well, I think some candor would have been nice. We could have started with the UIM evaluation to discuss where the discrepancy is. How much value did they put on the future loss of vision? Are they conceding that it's permanent loss of vision or permanent double vision, or are they just saying we only think it's worth 15?
And is it significant that they didn't volunteer that, in your view, or didn't furnish it when you were emailing and asking for that information?
Both. I think it gets a little bit, frankly, it's confusing as a lawyer when the court has said that this is an adversarial relationship. Because on one hand, we've got a first-party relationship, which is a high level. It's not a used car deal anymore. The court has said that it's quasi-fiduciary in Troughton. So we've got a quasi-fiduciary relationship that's providing a necessary public service. But on the other hand, they can hide evidence, which by itself, the failed processing we know from Juulsen, is adequate to support a bad faith claim as long as it's not work comp. And then when you add to it the components that eventually there are damages to it, we end up in a situation like this. Had there been no damages, or had they been able to demonstrate that they did fully investigate, they had a doctor who they wanted to rely on, like we just saw an insurance company trying Mordhorst, or a lawyer they wanted to rely on, like we saw, I believe it was Bertelsen, in the DM&E cases, where there's other excuses to get them to where they are. They got to argue about the $900,000 demand at the jury, too, to try to make Mr. Fichtner and myself look unreasonable. And it just didn't work. So, yeah, I absolutely think that there's cases I pass all the time that I don't think have the merit to go through trial on.
The low offer could be justified, conceivably.
Or no offer, sure, yeah. But that's the risk that the insurance company runs on the flip side by not making a payment, by not, in a way, they've created the situation for themselves by not allowing the adjuster to do what they can do. The adjuster had nowhere near the authority to even look at the claim, nor did the vice president of claims. They never, at any point in the trial, did anybody look at this case and claim that had the authority to settle for what we had demanded. No, at no point did they. Still to this day, as far as I know, they haven't. So the idea that they fully and fairly investigated this, they didn't take anything at face value that was being said, or at least it certainly doesn't appear that way. And for those reasons, it is a fair debate, and this is not how insurance is supposed to work. It's a business that's supposed to happen without lawyers and courts' involvement. And I think everybody, that's undisputed in this case.
If you win, what's the durable effect of, if you win with the arguments as you've got them, what's the durable effect of a published decision that accepts that? What do insurance companies do? What do they know? What do they glean from this in terms of a rule that would help them discharge their duties? I know that's not your job. I'm just curious.
Well, yeah, that I think the insurance industry already knows what to do. What happened about 30 years ago was they decided to start handling claims this way. They don't send people out in person anymore to meet the insured claimant.
But how do they take this case? I understand you feel that way, but how do they take this case and they say, yeah, I mean, we can correct here, or this provides something there, and now we know with some certainty what we have to do in order to meet our obligation?
Contact the claimant. Okay. Contact the claimant's physicians, perhaps. Contact an independent physician that's truly independent. Maybe do some actual medical literature research to compare what you know from medical records to the truth. And not allow just the single-sided, oh, I have a snapshot of the guy in the weight room on Facebook. He must not be hurt. Or here he is on an airplane with his daughter. He must not be hurt. They made the conscious decision to rely exclusively on those without asking anybody about it. And that there was never a debate because they never brought any of it up.
So if we had the same investigation and they would have offered $100,000 instead of $10,000, would you still have a bad faith case?
I mean, I think so. I think they would come with a lot more credibility to the jury that they could have offered or even paid that. And that's one last thing I'll leave now that I'm out of time, is that you don't have to release first-party claims. They just get paid. And this court's actually embraced that in Isaac.
So it isn't about how much they offer. It's about what they've done to arrive at the offer.
From my perspective. And then secondarily, are there damages? Because I see a lot more bad faith conduct, frankly, than I see bad faith conduct that causes damages. It's a functional equivalent of running a stoplight in the middle of the night. If you don't hit anybody, you break the law, yeah, but it's not worth it for me to get involved. I mean, I'm certainly not going to go all the way through trial on a case that I don't think is worthy. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Arntz, you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to start with rebutting any concept that there was improper withholding of any evidence in this case. The Exhibit 3, which is the admitted by the plaintiff at trial, the 8-page UIM evaluation that in detail evaluates Mr. Fichtner's claim, was produced in discovery, and it was admitted by plaintiff during trial.
Asked for the reason for the denial or why the claim was only $10,000, what did you arrive at? Did the insurance company provide it at that time?
I'm not aware of that request being made, and I haven't seen any evidence of that. So no, I can. Your Honor, that it was not produced until discovery.
You're not aware that opposing counsel sent a letter to the insurance company or sent an email to the insurance company saying, "Why? Tell me why you're only offering $10,000."
Absolutely, we included that email exhibit in the brief, right. And the adjuster provided the rationale of the police report, the speeds of the vehicle, those types of things.
Was the UIM, the 8-page UIM report prepared at that time?
No.
So that's prepared after the claim is evaluated?
I mean, it wasn't asked for. How would they know that?
But ultimately, does it really matter? Because the 8-page UIM claim wasn't satisfying to the plaintiff anyway.
I think that's exactly right.
Whenever they got it.
Was the $900,000 demand before the evaluation was done, or was that after?
No, I believe it was before. I think the UIM demand evaluation is dated in 2020. The emails, which are part of the court's record, before the litigation started were in 2019.
So you were already in an adversarial posture at that point, the insurer and the insured?
The insurer hired an attorney 4 days post-accident, and that's reflected in the insurer's, in Mr. Fichtner's chiropractic records, which we also referenced in these records. He immediately retained counsel. And that actually goes to another point, which of the things that plaintiff's counsel claims that American West should have done, contact the plaintiff. Okay, fair enough. But he was represented by counsel 4 days post-accident. It's not as if American West can pick up the phone and contact him when they know that he is represented by counsel, at least without going through counsel. Contact the plaintiff's medical providers. I don't think we have to suspend common sense when we're deciding these issues. There's a doctor-patient privilege that exists between the plaintiff and his physicians. There's a HIPAA requirement for those physicians. The idea that an insurance adjuster can pick up the phone, call an orthopod, get that...
They can certainly ask for a release from counsel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That also presumes that that doctor, on his own dime, is willing to talk to a third-party insurance adjuster willingly about his patient. I don't think there's any obligation to do that. Yes, the adjuster could try to do that. I think from a common sense perspective, the results of that are going to be a nullity.
So it seemed to come up at a number of times below at a trial, the fact that the adjuster dealing with the medical coverage had interacted with the providers, but that the adjuster for the UIM claim, there's a separation there, and they aren't the institutional issues that were raised as to how that is set up and why that is that relevant? And what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, how does that play? I can give you my thoughts on that. Whether it's relevant or not, I guess this court can determine, but. I mean, this is certainly part of the damned if you do, damned if you don't world of insurance, first-party insurance, attorney-driven, first-party insurance bad faith. If the claims between the MedPay adjuster and the UIM adjuster aren't separated, there are claims that the insurance company's acting in bad faith. There's different standards for MedPay coverage, which is essentially strict liability coverage for damages related to post-injury claims, than there are for an insurance adjuster who's adjusting a UIM claim and trying to figure out the inherent subjective value of a personal injury claim. So if those claims are commingled, you can bet plaintiff's counsel is going to claim that those claims files not being separated is in fact an act of bad faith. If you do separate them, as they attempted to do in this case, then you get kind of hindsight post-claim advocacy that, well, if the UIM adjuster would have just had access to the MedPay claim, she would have understood the claim better and she would have put a higher value on the claim. Either way, the insurance company is going to get sued for bad faith, whether they separate those claims or whether they give their adjusters access to those claims. And it's the same thing for the third item that plaintiff's counsel argues is something that the insurance company should have done in this case, which is to hire an independent medical examiner or an independent medical physician. I think this court is familiar with the claims in which first-party bad faith claims are based upon hiring a hired gun who's going to tell the insurance company whatever they want to hear. So they get sued for bad faith if they hire the independent medical examiner. And then in cases like this, where they simply rely on the medical records comprehensively as set forth in that 8-page UIM evaluation, they still get sued for not hiring the hired gun.
I think you answered Justice Devaney's question. Anybody else have questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, that will conclude arguments. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess.